CosmicRadio.tv. This podcast would be nothing without our patrons, so special thanks goes out to them. Want to join their ranks and support independent content? Head to our Patreon at patreon.com/8bitlife. Fine edition of my so-called 8-bit life. I'm your host, Roberto Vegas. Joining me today, host or part host of the Ritual Misery podcast, Ethan Kane, better known as Anthony or Amos, depending on how you know the man in whatever spectrum of the world you know him as. How's it going, good sir?
Hey, Roberto, man, it's been a day. It's been a fun day.
It's been a day? That's the most self-defeating way of saying something like, hey, how's it going? It's like, yeah, it's been a day, as opposed to it's been a week, it's been a month, it's been a year. I guess in the scale of being self-deprecating and just being like beaten down, I guess it's been a day is a lot better than it's been a year or it's been a month.
Well, you know, sometimes you just have to look at it one day at a time. So why worry about what happened yesterday? Today's a day, and we're making it more of a day, and it's a better day now that we started this.
So it's interesting because, like, we had just got done. In fact, I think you posted the episode I was on your podcast, which was Misery Podcast. Maybe a couple days ago?
So late, yes. Yeah, I posted it, I think, Monday night, actually.
Yes, yeah, and I was awake because I work a weird shift in my job. And it was funny listening back to that because I started noticing some of the weird tics I have in terms of that. Because it's rare that I listen back to how I talk. And depending on what the show is and how much gaining control I have of it, and also depends on how awake I am because I work a weird shift. And so it's always this, how much caffeine's in my system, how little caffeine's in my system, all the other things and variables that you really don't think about until you start really doing this more often. And it was weird hearing me say certain things and not being like, I wish you would not do that. I wish you would control this. I wish you wouldn't talk like that all the time, you know?
Oh, yeah. That's one of those things. My biggest crutch when I first started recording myself was the ums and ahs and all that. And I didn't realize I was even doing it until Bonnie Brushwood mentioned it on an episode she had listened to. And that really, really woke me up. And now I'm like super conscious of it to the point.
I'm okay with ums and ahs now, especially ums, just because every language and every culture has the filler word, sort of the idea of where your brain's thinking of something and they need something to kind of fill that sound. Like in Japanese, I think it's like, like you kind of elongate a verb, or you just kind of like, you do some other weird thing. I forget the other sounds you can do.
In Korea, it's,
yeah, something like that. I mean, each culture has that, you know.
It's engine undertone almost. It's really weird, but yeah.
Well, because if you're saying like you're like, Joto, you know, until you figure out what you're going to say.
Right. Yeah, they do a lot, especially in Japan, they'll carry the last vowel sound until the next thought comes to them. And as a non-Japanese speaker, you're like, is that a normal part of the word?
Because like in Japanese, if you have two... Well, yeah, no, if you have two, because that's important, because basically in Japanese, and yes, we're talking about Japanese once again, because I've been playing a lot of fucking video games with it, and that's just, we got to deal with people. I apologize if it's annoying to you. But in Japanese, if you put two verbs next to each other, you know, you say it longer. Like, it doesn't become this, like, magical word. Like, if you think in English, we had two E's next to each other, it kind of changes pronunciation. If you have an O and then a consonant, and then another E, it changes pronunciation. Like, it does certain things. Like, they modify in language.
So the best example I have of how different languages are different with the same sounds is Hawaiian. The Hawaiian language, you pronounce every single letter, whether it's a vowel or a syllable, or it doesn't matter. You're going to pronounce it. So I lived in the city of Aiea. It's A-I-E-A or A-E-I-A? A-E-I-A. And it's Aiea. Like, you have to pronounce each individual vowel or a consonant. So if there's two U's together, it's a oo. It's not just
Interesting. Okay. Because that's sort of the thing with Japanese is that, like, every word, usually you say everything exactly the same. If there's two vowels, you just elongate it, which is convenient and easy to then translate, but it's still this sort of challenging thing for, you know, foreigners to sort of read a word. And if you talk about the idea of that they're trying to think of a thought and they elongate the verb a little too long, it's like, is that part of the word? Is that how it works? Because, again, we have different ways that we kind of have connecting thoughts. Like, sometimes we don't say exactly what we're going to say unless we're reading a teleprompter, or we have some type of word behind us, like we're doing some type of VO that we have this script ahead of us. But if we're trying to think of what to say, we do things like we do we do you know, there's all these sort of in between sounds that we make. That,
and then you have the people that will make a sound, like a small sound, a partial syllable, over and over and over again. They're like, and you know they're not elongating a word at that point.
No. And again, it just, it all depends. And it's such a weird thing. I mean, language is always fun to talk about. And specifically, you know, I, like, one of the classes I had the most fun in was Intro to Linguistics in college, because we would break down all this sort of stuff and the idea of sounds and how your mouth produces them, and sort of the idea of when you say a fricative, you know, like a, with an F, and sort of sound like what your mouth does, what your tongue does. It always made for some fun things.
Now, what do you call the three zones in your mouth? Do you know? Because there's like the front zone, the mid zone, the back zone, and each one has different.
I honestly forget what the zones of the mouth are.
I didn't know what that was until someone had explained why there's so much about Monica Lewinsky. Because Monica is like the perfect word for that, because it was Monica. So it moves from front. And those words, like, just that when you say it rolls off the tongue, it literally rolls through the mouth.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. I never thought about that, because usually I know a lot of, like, I know a little bit of it. Like, in a lot of things I do know is such a, you know, I know a very basic idea of linguistics and sort of the idea of how words are done. I know a little bit more about Old English, and even that I know very little of. So, you know, you couldn't ask me, for example, you know, to read Beowulf to you in any capacity, but we can keep it like that. But I mean, I know at least, you know, the thing I always make when it comes about Old English, I always say that, I always use a joke of, like, you know, what do you think Old English is? And people always go, like, Shakespeare or something else. And it's, you know, it's actually more, you know, closer to Germanic in terms of a language. If you ever want to learn Old English, you actually have to learn it like a foreign language. It's insane.
Yeah, I read one more. So, damn it, where the hell was it? Somewhere I read that if you want to look at America and figure out the closest dialect of American English that would be to the old language, it's that southern drawl.
Yep, actually, it's close. Actually, the Appalachian Mountains are very close to how Old English was in terms of order of words and stuff like that. There's a lot of, you know, languages that, you know, if we talk about language English versus, let's say, Spanish, places like Spanish, France, and I think even Japan, I know at least France and Spain have these what's called the Royal Academies, these sort of places that set the language tone.
Right.
And we're not talking about just like word placement. We're talking about things like, you know, how do you say the weekend or those sort of things.
Right. It's like a formal language center. Yep. It's not just where in America where, oh, yeah, Webster says this. So,
well,
because,
like, the closest we get in English to the Royal Academy in terms of other places, and this is something that people very, you know, no, I'm guessing no one in the audience has ever tried to look through it. I've always wanted to pay for a subscription to this as an English major. The closest we get to that is the Oxford English Dictionary, and that sucker is insane. The only time I've ever had access to an OED was when I was in college. We had a digital access to it. But one of my professors had a compact version of the OED,
right?
Which basically was, here's like six to eight, you know, 10 books and a magnifying glass. Good luck, God bless. And it was just like, you had to do this sort of thing to look into. I was like, no, fuck that. We use a computer for this shit. This is what, 2020? I think at the time it was like 2015 or 2014. I didn't know, it was even less. It was like 2006 or something, you know, like at the point when I was in college. But I've always liked the OED because it shows I think the important things of when it comes to the English language that we don't really talk about, but the etymology of a word, sort of like it began its life here and it's here now. Like one of the better ones. Let's see. I'll ask you this, Anthony. Do you know the difference, the old difference between will and shall? It's okay if you don't. This is such a weird, obscure thing.
Just recently read into this on not about.com. Was it Grammar Girl? I don't know. One of those websites. I'm oddly into the English language without actually having studied it. I want to say that will is something that's predetermined and shall is being told to do so.
Yeah, it's actually the flip. So will is – but you're close, and that's actually closer than a lot of people know, because basically when the two words kind of existed, the reason – because we use them now, we use them interchangeably. Like, I will do this, I shall do this, you know, or shall kind of sounds a little old-fashioned.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're using shall, then, you know, people look at you funny, but they understand what you mean.
Right. So the difference was, I shall do this, meaning I'm going to do this based on my own action, meaning that this is going to be accomplished because I have said I will do this. Whereas if you said, I will do this, means it's going to happen, not because you as the individual person is going to do it, but because the will of God has sort of forced you to do so. So it's, you know, you were close enough in that, like, there is a subtle difference. It doesn't matter now, and the etymology of the word has completely changed, but that was the idea behind it, was depending on that. And that's where you get weird with the English language and how it works, especially when you start reading older works and you see those two words and you're trying to figure out what the author meant. Both of them are very subtle differences of like what it means and how that affects the story. Because if it's the idea of like the will of God is forcing me to, you know, fight for, you know, Cassandra's, you know, virginity or whatever. I'm making up the story. I'm making up the worst English piece of junk ever on the fly.
But then, but does Cassandra know there, there, and there?
That's right.
Like, let's get to the heart of the matter. Let's go to the easy stuff that people just can't figure out. And I still don't understand. Maybe it was because I was taught. I went to a lot of different schools when I was little. So I was taught, you know, first grade was different than second grade, was different than third grade, by not just by class, but by school, like state even. And well, I guess not state, region of Southern California. So each one of those words was always very specific to me. And then when I see people that screw it up, every time it's like a little tiny aneurysm just pops off in the brain.
Well, I think it's because a lot of times when it comes to there, and there, a lot of people don't quite understand what their auto text is doing. And I think that that's part of the case. The other part is, and for those who have no idea, especially you non-English speakers out there listening, or people who are just sort of beginning their journey into talking in the English language, for those who are, you know, well deep in their journey of the English language, you should know this. But for those who don't, we're talking about three different words that are pronounced exactly the same, but, you know, are spelled and mean entirely different things. There, T-H-E-Y, apostrophe R-E, a contraction of they are. There, T-H-E-R-E, meaning it is over there, some type of location, some type of thing. Or there, T-H-E-I, is it E-I-R? Yeah.
It's E-I-R.
E-I-R, my brain has to think of the spelling. Spelling's my poor sight. There, meaning it is theirs. This is their thing. In other words, sort of a possession or pointing out an object in terms of who owns it or what owns it or anything like that. And it gets tricky because, you know, people don't realize, I think, that they are exists and that there is the contraction, because there's even weird exceptions to that. For example, it's and its, being I-T-S and I-T apostrophe S.
That one is always one that I have to correct myself on. I'll type it I-T apostrophe S every single time, and then I'll rethink it as I'm finishing this sentence and have to go back and correct it if necessary.
What's funny is even to this day, there's the way I remember that those two ones, there is one of the episodes of Strong Bad Emails where he has to correct one of the emails that's spelled wrong. And so he has a song. It's like, oh, if you want to see it's possessive, it's just I-T-S. But if you want to make a contraction, it's I-T apostrophe S. scallywag. It's a silly thing, but my brain remembers that, and like that's what keeps me on track of like, is it it's? Is it it's? Okay, cool. Because there's even like weirder ones and even certain things that we don't think about. Like, I know people always get angry at the concept of the Oxford comma, sort of the extra additional comma that you don't really need, which I it like.
So much sense. I don't understand why people don't use it just all the time, because the rare instances where it actually makes a genuine difference, it makes all the difference.
Yeah, it's for me, I've always taken it as here is a way of keeping track of order and sort of
and separating thoughts, because yes, you can have, especially when you're describing things, you can have instances, and a lot of it is like an order of operands on the words. Like, you want to describe the most generic things first and get more specific as the sentence goes on, so that the specifics or the characteristics of what you're describing later in the sentence don't accidentally get attributed to the beginning of to the first subject of the sentence. Really, man, I think I said that right.
It's okay. It's one of those things that, I mean, again, language is always fun. It's one of my favorite all-time things to talk about language and to that. I should point out live, for people watching live, if you're watching this and you want to know what chat room we're in, just head over to cosmicradio.tv/ or twitch.tv/cosmicradio.tv. We're in the chat. So join in the fun there. But yeah, because language gets weird. And I say weird in that when you start looking at the history of things, and you start to history, because again, even like the Japanese language, like a lot of the hiragana, katakana characters are actually based on... The history of that is they liked kanji so much, but kanji was a little too hard to write for rural Japanese people at that time in terms of history. So they made this simplified version of the kanji-esque language and made that hiragana and katakana, and sort of made this is how we will use these syllables to form words.
But then they all blended them all together and then sprinkled it with a bunch of English. And man, what a language.
It's because, again, you know, like, English hasn't had to deal with that, because English by nature has always been, since day one, a borrowing language. We borrow a ton of words. We borrow a ton of concepts from a different language. The way I explain it, and the best way I pitch it to people who don't quite understand it's a borrowed language, is I do it like this. And let's see if, Anthony, you can chime in on this.
Okay.
Let's say I want to get a letter notarized. Where would I go to do that? Like, legally notarized, who would I go to? A
notary.
What's the last word? There's one other word that usually typically happens after that one.
Notary public.
Right. Now, here's a quick English lesson. If I want to say this house is white, I would call it the
White House.
Right. So in the language of the White House, house is a subject, white is the verb. In other words, that's the order we do. We typically do verb, subject in terms of language, or object.
Yep.
In terms of how we want to describe something, and the idea of, you know, we don't say, for example, house white, like you would in right. Latin, in a Latin-based language like Spanish or French.
Right.
So let's go back to notary public. Is republic the subject, or is notary the subject?
Right. Notary is clearly the subject.
Right. It's the object.
And public is almost so because of its placement, it's not like you wouldn't go to the public notary.
Right. So the point behind that, and this is where it gets interesting, when it came to our legal terms in terms of the English language, they didn't start coming into fashion until the Gauls, essentially the original French, took over the Isle of Britannia, you know, basically England, and started bringing all their legal terms. And because of that, we have the idea of all our legal terms are Latin-based, like notary public. And if you start looking at how words are lingua franca, you know, like a very common-based linguistic term and sort of legal term. Because of that, that's why all of our legal terms have this sort of reverse order. They're based off Latin. They're not even based off of English concepts, which is cool. And that's sort of, you know, I always use that as my example of how the English language is this borrowing language, because it's something that's so quintessential to how we do things. You know, it's all Latin based and we don't even think about it. We don't say like notary public and not even think about what that means and why that's strange, unless you start analyzing, saying, oh yeah, that is strange, but why is that? You know,
So something that gets me about the English language in particular, and of course it's the only language I'm fluent in, so I'm not going to try to say that, you know, this happens in other languages or it doesn't. But and my wife is famous for this, and I wish I could think of one right off the top of my head. But when you have a cliche, like something that's said all the time, and then you replace one word with another word that sounds like it, it changes the meaning of the text, but people still understand the purpose of the cliche. And they still get the message across, even though you've changed the actual wording. And my wife is famous for this. Man, I really wish I could think of one. But all the time she's saying, you know, she'll do an old cliche, and it'll be just one word off of what the cliche should be. But everybody just goes right along with it, and doesn't even realize that that's what she said.
Well, because I think a lot of people sort of have their own filter. Like, they will figure out what someone's meaning. Like, there's a lot of when it comes to reading language, you know, there's always that famous post people tend to link to where they'll miss every other word, but your brain will fill in the sort of the blanks because it knows kind of what to do. The brain has a lot of error correction going on, whether or not you know it is or isn't. That's sort of why editing's so important. That's why it's so important to have somebody there else to check your work. Not because you're going to make an error. It's because you're going to make an error and not even realize you made an error. And when it comes to language, it's very easy to drop a word, to write something a bit more casually, to write like you're speaking, and that's not quite how it goes. And sort of even in terms of when you see like a news report, you'll see those things in brackets where it's a name. It's just make it clear of like who the heck the person's talking to, even though you as the interviewer know exactly who the person you're interviewing is talking about, but you want to make it clear to your readers this is who they're addressing. They're just saying he, meaning any various he, they're talking about he, you know, some important person or not.
How do you feel about the like the word puzzles where you read a paragraph and they'll say how many F's are in this paragraph and you're not counting the F's that are in the of's, or it'll say find the error and you'll read it like three times and you won't catch it because there's a double the somewhere in there, and your brain just skips right over it.
That's the point. That's the idea. Your brain does all this error checking without you knowing it, which is cool. And I think that's awesome that your brain can kind of understand things and sort of decode what they're trying to do and skip over things and sort of address it. And especially if we read things out loud, it does that automatically. It's really cool, just the idea that your brain, in terms of the language you're used to reading, is able to do that. Usually when you start seeing a lot more of those errors, when you start learning foreign languages and sort of figure out those things, because there's a lot of different mechanics and how, not just how questions are worded, how things are phrased. Like one of the challenges of localization is that idea of making these foreign concepts of either humor or culture a little bit more digestible to other foreign cultures, whether it be English or, you know, European or something like that. And that becomes, you know, the idea of the joke of like what, like I always think of there's always a great example of this in specifically Earthbound. There's a moment in the game where you're sort of knocking on doors and kind of just chat with random people. And in one of the doors you knock in the English version, it says, finish this title for a song. Blank, 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 today. Or no, blank, 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 today. Like E-T, anyway, yeah. And you have two options. You have yes or no. Obviously, the answer is yes, because it's a Beatles song, Yesterday, which a lot of people know. It's a very popular song and whatnot. In the Japanese version, it says finish this song title blank 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 D, like that, and your answers are yes and no in Japanese, which is hai and ie. Now the reason, and if you finish it with hai, it actually forms Heidi, as in like the, you know, song of music, which is actually a very popular song in terms of Japanese history for some reason that everyone latched onto that. So the joke in Japanese is, you know, it would never translate to English. You know, you couldn't have like finish this sentence, you know, blank, blank, blank D, you know, yes or no, because that's the joke. The joke is it's yes or no in Japanese. And so you translate that, doesn't work out. So you have to sort of say, well, what was the gag that the writer wanted? And the gag they wanted was the idea of what popular song title would fill this void here. And I've always found that like as a great example of localization, because it's like something that if you just literally translated, it wouldn't work.
Right.
You know, and I was – it's one of those fun ones. There's actually a book.
There's so much of that in video games, especially in like the late 80s, early 90s. You'd run into that all the time. Ninja Gaiden was was so every time there was text on screen, something was not quite translated right.
Well, there's a lot of cases of that, and a lot of times because there's ultimately various forms of translation. We're obviously really familiar with literal translation, which is just word whatever the heck words equal this, you know, and that's a fun translation for sure. There is machine translation, which we're all very now familiar with, and you can all have fun in your own land when this goes up on YouTube. Just flip on the auto translate and auto thing and see what happens. It'll be a magical journey, and I guarantee you're going to have fun. Do it any page. Just go to Google Translate, pop in whatever, see what happens. It becomes magical. It is magical. It's very fun because it makes absolutely no sense, and you'll try to figure out what the sentence. I've done it with a lot of friends who have who will typically post from Japan. I'll go like, all right, let me use the Facebook translation feed. I think I understand what they're trying to say.
In Korea, I would use it a lot. Was it Google Goggles?
Yep.
Where you just point at it and it would try to translate it. And, you know, because you're at the store and you're trying to figure out something out. And one of the things that I've remarked on before is, you know, trying to find, if you go into a 7-Eleven or a Family Mart or whatever in Korea and you want to buy toothpaste, you got to make sure you're not buying hernia cream.
Right.
You know? And you point your little thing, your camera at the box or the tube, and it doesn't tell you what it is. You know, whatever it translates to is something completely off the wall. And you're like, I don't want that. Whatever that is, I don't want it.
It's like, I don't need that. Like, I don't know. Like, why do I need bicycle fluid? What is bicycle fluid? Like, is it an oil? Are you sure this is a toothpaste? Is this a Crest box? I didn't know Crest made type bicycle fluid. Interesting. Well, I guess I'll get this other thing. What is this? Duck cream? Are you sure?
You try to think, what could that?
Yes.
What meaning might that, what should that mean?
Yeah, you go through your brain of like, okay, what is it they're trying to tell me? Why is this say duck randomly? Is this what I, like, okay, I think I understand. Okay, cool. But yeah. And
I found that the bigger the group of friends you have, you can either end up with a greater rate of success on the manual translation and the greater chance of hilarity ensuing. When you're with the larger the group you are, the better chances you have of those things. Someone's going to think of it, and someone else is going to come up with something completely wrong that's going to make you laugh your ass off.
Yeah, no, it could be fun, but yeah, so there's localization. There's direct machine, and the last one is localization. I think there's a couple other ones in between, but I forget the rest of them. But the idea of like localization is where you take the words, you study it, and you go, okay, what is the author trying to say? What is the writer trying to convey? What is the speaker trying to actually say? And then translate out that to the other language. And that can be fun. Like the hardest part is there's a lot of puns in Japanese, and there's, you know, there's puns in every language. It's fun to do, but they just do not translate at all. I think I was talking to, I forget what friend of mine I was talking to, but we had the same kind of conversation where there's like a ton of Spanish jokes that if you just heard literally, it's always my cousins will say like, it's funny in Spanish. I'm like, okay, cool. I'll keep that in mind. Not knowing what the hell they're talking about.
That makes me feel good. Yeah, thanks.
Well, there is. I mean, like, it's humor is that thing that's very culturally, and even in terms of, like, if you think of just Western culture and how many subcultures there are, there's, like, certain jokes that you couldn't tell another subculture about.
Right.
Like, if you think of some of the inside jokes of sort of Chat Realm and Diamond Club, you know, like the pizza, like those sort of weird things. If you told anybody else that, they'd look at you completely like, why is that funny? You know, not because it's not funny to them, not because it couldn't be funny to them, but it's such a subculture joke. Or even think of the idea of memes is about the closest we get to sort of exchanging subculture jokes because we can kind of do those sort of things. Yeah. Like if you think of the concept.
Usually there's a visual element to a meme as well. It's usually just, well, I mean, I guess it technically could be, but in modern times on Facebook and Twitter and the snaps and whatever else whatever else them kids are using today.
there's
a new element to it that gives you some sort of key and clue, and if you're really in on it, then you have another level of enjoyment of the meme. Meanwhile, you can still get it.
Well, because we're at a point now where you can start doing like there's almost a meme template. Like if you think of the idea, and this is my favorite, one of my all-time favorite meme templates, because it's based upon an image, specifically a screen grab from a specific Disney cartoon, and all they did was put glasses on it. The hipster Ariel meme, where it's you just have Ariel that made this sort of scrunchy face. If you put glasses on, it's like she's looking at you like disgusted, like, I can't believe you plebe, you listen to this, you know, thing. I put on my 45 of Depeche Mode or whatever. I don't know what I listen to fucking 333s. I listen to vinyl records, roller shakes. I have to always do a hipster check on myself because of that. Because the only way I know that I'm not fully hipster is that I still listen to a lot of digital. You know, I realized I'm not full hipster yet, and thank God I'm not. When I went to we have a record store here in Austin called Waterloo, and I was in the vinyl section, kind of just looking around, seeing what to buy, and I heard some people talking about how they only listen to music on vinyl and only heard the latest. They had only heard the newest A Tribe Called Quest album because it was played at NPR. I was like, okay, thank God, I'm not there yet. I'm able to listen to music because I listened to it digitally well before. I'm like, oh, thank God, I'm not there yet. Whew.
I fall more in the underfunded enthusiast level. That's where I'm at. That's that's my level of hipster.
Well, it's a constant check I do on myself because I play retro video games, I listen to vinyl, records and whatnot, and analyze and try to find obscure music. Like I always have to do this constant thread of like, am I too hipster? Am I at this point where I'm just disgusted with certain things?
A moment of honesty here. I've never owned an album, like a pressed album.
Really?
Yeah, never 45, 33, none of it. I've never even had owned a record player.
It wasn't until recently that I started getting back into records. And a lot of times I have a rule now, and this has sort of been my ultimate rule that I've never really talked about, but it makes sense now. If I get a record, it has to be something that I A, have heard digitally or own digitally or some type of fashion, and more importantly, B, means something to me. Like, for example, even though the quality doesn't even matter at all because it's chiptunes, I have a copy of the Undertale soundtrack. I have a copy of Shovel Knight on vinyl because those are things that are important to me. You know, I have the Mother 2 soundtrack on vinyl that they repressed from Ship to Shore because that means something to me. But anything, it's not like I'm going there like, oh, let me pick up the new this. Let me pick, it's got to be very, very specific, very things, or that, like, I have a couple of Mega Ran on vinyl and stuff like that that have been signed.
But my thing with music, I mean, to me, the music itself is interpretive. Like, some people can hear different songs different ways. You know, you may hear the bass more than I do, or I may hear the vocals more than you do. You kind of get to focus on whatever you find is important. And I've never found the format to be mind blowing. Once you reach a minimum MP3 level, it's maybe I'm just not the audiophile. I don't have the ears for it or whatever. But for me, the experience comes in watching it or being present live, whether that's in studio when it's being recorded or on stage or, just a little shindig, wherever. If there's live music, and this is one of the reasons I love Austin. This is one of the reasons I'm so excited I'm coming there for a full week instead of just a weekend this year.
Oh shit, you're coming for music.
I'm coming for a full week.
I'm gonna have to drag you to things then, because weird thing is I got to drag a few choice chat realmers with me to various musical functions.
Yeah.
And that wasn't just Japan Night. I don't think I dragged anyone to Japan Night. I take it back. I don't remember who's still in town or not. But I ended up dragging Curtis LaRock to, and a couple of people as well, to a chiptune show. South by Square by Square Wave was the event name. It sometimes happens, sometimes doesn't. Depends on the year. But because of that, I got to drag a whole bunch of people with me. And I hope it happens early this week, because this is a very jam-packed music session. It's kind of weird, all the stuff going down. Like, Thursday of music is Tokyo Ska Paradise Orchestra's performing, which is an amazing ska band out of Japan. Japan Night's happening Friday, and then Saturday is the Nerdcore Night, and everything else is happening at, other times and everything else like that. It's going to be a very interesting South By. But for me, the reason I will listen to something on vinyl, and this is what's become very apparent when I put on a vinyl, because if I think about how I listen to music, usually I listen to it in the car. Usually I have some type of music playlist playing and kind of, you know, listen that way and jam out that way. With vinyl, because I kind of don't have the ability to sort of pick a track easily or replay a track effectively, I will usually just let it play on through and sort of listen to it. And I've started becoming very aware of especially older albums that were aware of that format. Like one of the, I think, quintessential albums to own on LP that I still need to buy because of the way it does things is Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd. Mm-hmm. Because unless you know how a vinyl works in that you had a side A and a side B, you don't quite know. Like as a kid, when I heard my dad play Pink Floyd, I would hear it like, why is there a stop? This weird stop in the middle of the song, you know, the middle of that, where everything else had just kind of continued float on through. Why does it stop here? Not knowing that, oh, it stopped there because that was the end of the side, and that was as much info as they could fit on this goddamn record. There's no more place to put this on. It was it. That was it. And then you flipped on the B side and you heard the rest of the album, and that's why it ends there. Like, oh, well, that makes a lot more sense.
They had strategically planned that placement for concept albums,
right? And exactly.
It really gave a life to the idea of a concept album. Something you could just literally put the needle at the beginning, let it play all the way through, and have, you know, Mastodon is really good about this. You end up with like this roller coaster of different songs that kind of feed into each other, and you end up with this big crescendo, and then it kind of comes crashing down right towards the end of the second side. But they always had to place that dip, the nadir of the album, right there in the middle, so you could go over there and flip it and let it play the rest of the way through.
Yeah. There's also like another concept that I've only began learning, the idea of what's called lock track, where you could basically, if you look at a record at the edge of at the end of the what's called the wax, basically the album itself, you could put a track there that sort of that continually spins, so you don't damage your needle, right, as you let it play by accident. It just sort of loops back, sort of locks in there, keeps it in motion. What people started doing was actually putting information on there and putting musical things. One of the best ones is I think Monty Python on their record put there, you let this record on too long, and it would continually say that phrase as it looped around and around and around and around. I'm like, that's so freaking brilliant to do that kind of silly thing, to have that idea of using this to make this endless kind of loop, yep. You know, knowing how much seconds was there. I was like, that's brilliant. That's funny. And people started doing that with music, and I find that really cool, the concept of those things, or like the hidden track of a song that's like hiding in some like I think the Homestar Runner Strong Bad songs for Frost and People, whatever, the last song has this like giant gap of dead, and then it comes to like secret song, like a song sung by Homestar. That's funny as hell. And I love those sort of hidden things, and I didn't learn about those until, especially the lock track, until I looked into records. I was like, what's this lock track? I'm like, oh, that. Or the idea of, you know, and I think you feel free to chat, chime in your opinion on this one, but I've always loved the concept of backmasking. Or is it backtracking? Is it backmasking or backtracking? I forget.
Backmasking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The idea where you have a song played in reverse and it reveals something like Paul is dead from the Beatles. And
right, right. If it's done intentionally, I don't know that any of the Beatles stuff was like intentionally. I think those are all just coincidences. But there are bands that have done certain arrangements in a song, and if you're listening, you can hear it like, okay, that's an odd arrangement right there. And then you backplay it, and oh, okay, well, because they had another bit right there. All right, good.
Yeah, the really good example of that is Weird Al Yankovic's. I think it's I'm not sure if that's your horoscope for today. I can't remember which song it is, but there's one of the songs. It might be Frank's 2000 Inch TV, where if you played it in reverse, I'll remember the song when it comes to me, but if you play it in reverse, it will. I think if you look it up, Anthony, let me know, because
I remember Larry.
Yeah, I remember Larry. That's right. At the very end, the back mask is like, if you do this, like you've been, you know, like you have far too much free time on your hands, something along those lines. Because it's like right there at the back. And I always heard as a kid, like, what the hell is this? This sounds like, you know, garbage. And it's a fun back mask. It's one of those ones I've always enjoyed, that Weird Al was just like, let's have fun with this, because that was during the era of like, if you play this in reverse, you can hear, you know, Hail Satan or some, you know, weird thing like that.
So you mentioned hidden tracks at the end of albums, and I remember, so the first time I ever really noticed this was at the end of Alanis Morissette's album, Jagged Little Pill or whatever.
Yeah.
At the end of the album was the main track, the initial release. What the hell was it? You Ought to Know.
Yeah,
I don't know, but it had Flea playing bass, and it was such a better version of the song just by Flea just whipping out that bass and just going crazy with it. But, you know, and that song was like 7.5 minutes after the last track on that CD. Okay, fine. And then you get to Antichrist Superstar by Marilyn Manson. That CD had 99 tracks on it. There were 14 tracks or whatever of actual music, and then it just counted up and counted up and counted up. And the last track was just 1 second of just complete garbage. But if you had that CD on, or if you were playing, if it was in like a disc player, yep, a multi-disc player, and you had it on random, guaranteed it would play an empty track like 43 times before it ever played a song on that record.
That's a fun idea, and that's because this is also where you start getting weird things you can fool with, and I always love this one. So when we talk about music albums and sort of formats, you know, vinyl has sort of what's called the RIAA sound format, whatever. When it comes to an audio CD, the spec that it utilizes, it's called the Red Book standard. I forget exactly what the specifications are, but certain things like the audio quality has to be like 44.1 kilohertz, and you know,
it's like
that
ISO 99 something or whatever.
Right, but I know it as the Red Book name. I forget the rest of the specs, but one of them is you can only have so many tracks on a CD, I think. And I think 99 was the limit for Red Book. It might have been something else.
It's 79 minutes and 59 seconds. And
right, because it was the idea. This is where it gets really...
Well, originally it was 74 minutes and like 2 seconds or whatever.
Well, because the esoteric thing is like a track has to be, I think, like 2 to 3 seconds in length or something weird like that. Like, it's a lot of weird things that you don't really have to deal with if you make real music. It's when you start doing funky shit like that where you have to go and say, oh, what is the minimum length of the track? How many tracks can I put on this thing? At what point does it become insane? You know, and that's sort of the joke behind it. I always, again, love those gags, love them so much because they take the idea of the format and say, how do I even play with this and make something funny out of this, or make something a gag or whatever? Because you could have like I remember the Killer Instinct CD had like, you know, a ton of blank tracks just to get somewhere, you know. And then like the 14th track was like the humiliation, you know, like that sort of thing. It's a funny to get. Again, I love those things.
There'd actually be a lot of this on exports. If you like one of the Metallica albums, if you bought it in Japan, it had a couple extra like songs from other albums on it, but it had random blank tracks in between. So the back of the album said, you know, song one, song two, song three, song four, but it was like track one, track five, track 19, track 42. And it was this really weird layout. And I don't know if that was like a legitimate thing or just something I found at a Just Go, but whatever.
I'm looking at it says here,
the standard is IEC 60908.
Yeah, and basically it says a CD can contain up to 99 tracks. Each track can in turn have up to 100 indexes. I'm trying to find out. I'm trying to think what the minimum track length is. I guess if it's 99 divided, you know, you take 75 divided by 99 or something. I think it's like a 2 or 3 seconds. I forget the exact limit, but it's a weird thing, and it's weird because of the way it even handles a CD. Like, all this stuff is such a... It's one of those specs that if you know the spec, it's cool, and you can kind of, you know, fuck with it and have some fun. But it's one of those specs that just so... I mean, it's esoteric to us as how we tend to view things, but I always enjoyed it. I always enjoy the idea of screwing with formats and sort of having fun with that, you know, making it part of your CD. Like, another really fun thing I think is always cool is the... I think it's the... is it audio spectrum? I forget the term where you basically hide pictures in audio. Because like one of the albums, specifically, if you want to have fun with this, people, and you want to know just how crazy the mind of Phil Fish was, and even the guy that did the soundtrack for it, Disaster Piece. If you analyze the audio of each of the songs for the Fez soundtrack, you'll actually find images hidden in some of the tracks, looking like they're like a QR code or something like that. It's bizarre and fun. But it's, you know, it's cool as hell. And I've always liked, again, I like the idea of taking your thing and putting some, you know, hiding something in the in there that only if you're like really caring about finding like the idea of it, those sort of Easter eggs and things like that. At least for me, you know.
Now you have me obsessed with trying to find out how the shortest track on a CD.
Well, because I don't remember. I think the only reason I know that is because of the empty track kind of concept. That's the only reason I know this is the idea of you hide this stuff, and then and a lot of CDs would do this because, you know, if it was just at the end and it wasn't labeled, it was like, ooh, look, it's a hidden track. You had to like, you have to kind of dig. It's like you're hiding something. You're like,
I saw, what was it? Dang it. Now my memory is failing me. One album that I was looking at, I didn't buy it because I thought it was just completely ridiculous. But it actually said at the end, it said hidden track and gave the track number for the track of the hidden track. And I was like,
I'd like to say Mushroomhead did that too, where like the last, like I think the album name was 42 and the hidden track was like 42. I think that's what they did.
This one actually said like on the back, it said, you know, here's a list of songs and it said hidden track, colon, and gave the name of the track. And I was just like, that ruins
the magic.
You just lost an album sale.
It ruins the magic because I think that's half the, again, to me, a hidden track or something, you know, Easter egg of some sort is, you know, when it comes to the talk of, you know, the, how do I best put it? When it comes to that, I always feel that is a conversation with the artist in, you know, that we're both in on this sort of hidden thing that the artist is like, okay, I know you're a fan. And let's see what level of fandom you are. Let's see how well we get each other. And when you find that hidden track, when you find that sort of hidden bit of information gem, I feel that that's sort of the artist saying, all right, cool. You're in on the same gag as I am. You're in on the same information as I am. We are now having as best as we can through a musical album beyond just the lyrics of that. We're having this, you know, inside thing where it's like, all right, welcome to the club. And I've always viewed those sort of hidden tracks or sort of backmasking or some type of hidden concept in albums is like you're in on more than just the concept of the album or just the song or even the hit track. You're now part of this like cool kids club.
Yeah. And that's really what, I mean, that's kind of like building a miniature community amongst your fans, you know, and if you're in, you're in. If you're out, you usually don't know you're out.
Right. And I think that's, I mean, again, it's cool to me because I like that idea. I like the idea of hiding those things, of doing stuff like that because it's fun. It's not, it's more of the like, well, why are there this many empty tracks? I wonder when, you know, will I hear anything? Click. No.
Well, that's exactly how I found that empty track at the end of the Antichrist Superstar. Yeah. Album. Like why what, you know, because you the old CD players, for those too young to remember, you'd put the CD in and you'd close the lid or slide it in or whatever else, and the first thing the player did was spin it up real quick and check the maximum, like the highest number of track, and it would display the number of tracks on the album and you would see it, and on that particular one it'd load 99 and you're like, what what the hell is the 99th one? I was there clicking, and it's just 1 second, and it's done. I'm like, that was a waste. Left it in there, started playing, and every other random song was one of their damn empty tracks. Like, you can't play that song by. Like,
it's hard to hide that stuff. I think it's hard because, like, because again, do you A, make a separate hidden track like that, or do you B, add like this giant chunk thing at the end of the track and then do something with it? Like, it's.
Right.
It's again the idea of like, well, how do we do this hidden thing? Because again, I love the idea of the hidden. I love the idea of
now. That. My question to you then is: if you were producing an album and you were going to produce it, like you want to do something special on a CD or a record or a tape or any of the audio formats that we have, I guess excluding MP3, unless you can figure out something really cool to do with that. What hidden trick or whatever else would you use? What's your method of choice to find out who the real fans are?
So if it were an MP3, I would probably hide something. I would probably do something either lyrically, or if it was a kind of instrumental thing, I would do something. I'll put it this way. So I've always thought about this when it comes to files and stuff like that. And if it were an MP3 and digital and I had like complete control of how it was distributed, I would do something weird like hide it in a header or put it in the hex code someplace. Like if you looked at the MP3 file through a hexadecimal editor or just looked at a tag editor, it'd be hidden in some type of tag with a link or something like that. That'd be one way of doing it. If it were a CD, I'd screw with the format entirely. I'd have fun. I'd look at the Red Book standard and say, like, what can I do? What can I do? How can I hide something in this one? Hide like some type of weird digital file or something like that. If it's a record, of course, I'm playing with the lock track because that's just a fun thing to play with. And let's have some fun with that kind of thing. But something where it takes advantage of whatever the format is and how I can hide information.
So what do you think about what do you think about having a lock track that is a fuzz in the clearest fidelity you can run, but that fuzz, if you break it down and play it super slow, or just, you know, look at the record and look at the notches on it, it's actually like Morse code.
That's a level I have not prepared for, but I love the idea behind it. Essentially it begins the mission, so to speak. Again, if you're doing that kind of level of stuff and you're hiding a Morse code in that, like, you better be getting a mission. You better be like, this is the beginning of your adventure into the world. Like what they've been doing.
Because what you do is you use that Morse code translated. It says something along the lines of, you know, find the tape.
There's a Rooster's program that's kind of ending now. We're almost out of time. We're basically at the hour mark right already here. called 11 Little Roosters, where they always had like interactive component, but this time they've gone like hardcore in the interactive component and they've been hiding things. There's actually at one point one of the videos to find the extra information you need to figure out who's going to be murdered in the next episode. You have to go to a previous episode of another video short that is like teased in there. And it requires a sort of deep forensic knowledge of not just Rooster Teeth, but just sort of like, oh shit, that's the kangaroo they're talking about over here. Go back to this. Holy crap, there's the Bitly code. And it's insane and fun and crazy and stuff. So I think you can, there are ways to do it. You just have to really plan to do so.
What I'm thinking is the Morse code on the record takes you to the tape at a certain point on the tape, like whatever time code that is.
Yep.
It'll actually have a decryption key printed on the magnetic tape where there's no sound. And then you take that over to the MP3, the official MP3 version, and then you figure out – that gives you a sequence once you decrypt it with
the steganography of information.
And then you take that sequence to the CD and take certain the whatever bits it is on there, and that will actually create a new song or a new message.
Anthony, whenever you decide to make your Ritual Misery album, I will remember this conversation, and I will buy it on all the formats, and we will go this way. Anthony, a complete and utter pleasure to have you on the show this week. Let's say people are unfamiliar with your podcast, and because they've enjoyed this conversation you and I had, perhaps they want to join in on the Ritual Misery fun. Where can people go to get all the fun stuff that you do and the voodoo that you do, speaking of music?
A little David Bowie there. The best place to go would be ritualmisery.com, RITUALMISERY. It's nice and easy to remember and not so easy to say. Ritualmisery.com. And there you'll find all of the podcasts that my friend Kent and I do, several different types of podcasts. Mostly you'll find the Ritual Misery podcast, in which Kent and I, with 30 years of friendship history, will shoot the shit with whatever guest we get on that week, usually someone in either Diamond Club or elsewhere in the geeky world. And we'll have a lot of fun. We'll bring up random stuff and we'll talk about our week and anything else that comes up.
Cool. Of course, you could anywhere they can get you up on Twitter if they want to chat with you further.
That's Ethan Kane, at Ethan Kane, ETHANCAINE. And of course, you can always follow the show at Ritual Misery.
Of course, you can find me. I'm at Vincent404 there on the Twitter. If you want to catch previous episodes of the podcast, you can go to our website, cosmicradio.tv/8bitlife. There you'll find links to the show notes, our Twitter account for the show, which is at 8bitlife podcast. And of course, the Patreon, which is patreon.com/8bitlife, and help the show become bigger, better, and more awesomer. If you're watching this recorded and you want to join us live, we usually record live on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Central at twitch.tv/cosmicradio.tv. And on, if you are more familiar with other things, you can go to diamondclub.tv as well, and we're broadcast everywhere. We're simulcasted about 8 different places, I think, at this point. Like, there are 5 different services that are broadcasting the signal as we speak. For no reason whatsoever. But that's the nature of the web.
We just stick to Diamond Club. Thursday nights at 7 Pacific.
There you go. Well, that's it for the day. See you next time. Talking to another geek about something completely and utterly random. Bye, people.
This has been a CosmicRadio.tv audio production. For more awesome shows, head on over to our website, CosmicRadio.tv.